hope you enjoyed a lovely 4th of July weekend. I was on the coast for the annual family picnic, which is always a lot of fun. A younger cousin, whom I haven't seen in years, attended and shared an interesting story about the day of his birth. Three girls were born to his parents before he made an appearance. When it was announced he had a son, his father took to the streets loudly and drunkenly, resulting in him being handcuffed in the middle of Main Street. Wait, there's more. The doctor who delivered my cousin was unavailable to sign the birth certificate because he had jumped off a bridge. There's no signature on the birth certificate. Any interesting stories in your family? Cities and towns have stories too. And before I visit one that I haven't before, I like to research the background, the origins of the town and city. If you've never visited Old Sacramento, California, you'll enjoy this interview with Phil Sexton, State Park Interpreter 3 of Capital District State Museums and Historic Parks. But first, here's an earlier introduction, a letter excerpt written by Mark Twain in 1866. I arrived in the city of saloons this morning at 3 o'clock, in company with several other disreputable characters, on board the good steamer Antelope, Captain Poole, commander. I know I am departing from usage in calling Sacramento the city of saloons instead of the city of the plains, but I have my justification. I have not found any plains here yet, but I have been in most of the saloons, and there are a good many of them. You can shut your eyes and march into the first door you come to and call for a drink, and the chances are that you will get it. And in a good many instances, after you have assuaged your thirst, you can lay down a 20 and remark that you copper the ace, and you will find that facilities for coppering the ace are right there in the back room. In addition to the saloons, there are quite a number of mercantile houses and private dwellings. They've already got one capital here, and will have another one when they get it done. They will have fine dedicatory ceremonies when they get it done, but you will have time to prepare for that. You needn't rush down here by express. You can come as slow freight and arrive in time to get a good seat. The houses in the principal thoroughfares here are set down about 8 feet below the street level. This system has its advantages. First, it is unique. Secondly, it secures to the citizen a firm, dry street in high water, whereon to run his errands and do her shopping, and thus away with the expensive and perilous canoe. Thirdly, it makes the first floors shady, very shady, and this is a great thing in a warm climate. Fourthly, it enables the inquiring stranger to rest his elbows on the second-story windowsill and look in and criticize the bedroom arrangements of the citizens. Fifthly, it benefits the plebeian second-floor boarders at the expense of the bloated aristocracy of the first. That is to say, it brings the plebeians down to the first floor and degrades the aristocrats to the cellar. Lastly, some persons call it a priceless blessing because children who fall out of second-story windows now cannot break their necks as they formerly did, but that this can strictly be regarded in the light of a blessing is, of course, open to grave argument. But joking aside, the energy and the enterprise the Sacramentans have shown in making this expensive grade improvement and raising their houses up to its level is in every way creditable to them and is a sufficient refutation of the slander so often leveled at them that they are discouraged by the floods, lack confidence in their ability to make their town a success, and are without energy. A lazy and hopeless population would hardly enter upon such costly experiments as these when there is so much high ground in the state which they could fly to if they chose. Now here's my interview with Phil Sexton about Old Sacramento. So Old Sac has quite a few historic buildings just on the, how many acres is it?
Well, the state park is 7 acres, but Old Sacramento Business District is about 14 or 16 acres. And it represents the real early center of Sacramento. It was preserved in the 1960s by moving Interstate 5 when they built it. They had originally intended to come through here and demolish this, but wise people recognized how important this was to California's history, and it was preserved as one of the first urban renewal projects for historic preservation in the nation.
And when was the freeway?
The freeway was constructed in the mid-1960s, and it's difficult to pin down just a date for it because freeways don't just suddenly appear one day. It had been planned as early as the 1950s. Routes were sketched in on maps, and one route was right through what is now Old Sacramento, right along the riverfront. That would have been perhaps similar to the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco before the earthquake. Another route had been sketched in that was right across the river in West Sacramento, where the ziggurat is today. And that was not liked by the business leaders of Sacramento because they felt it would take business away from the city of Sacramento. Ultimately, somebody chose a site that is about 4 blocks in from the riverfront. That's why there is no 4th Street in this part of Sacramento. And so that was the path that Interstate 5 was taken. Old Sacramento sits on the west side. Modern Sacramento sits on the east side of it. And Old Sacramento was preserved as a result.
This was a major port, I would assume, for the county or the area?
Well, this was the major port for the state. Actually, San Francisco always has been. But in the 19th century, if you came to California to get gold and you came around the Horn or across the Isthmus of Panama, you sailed into San Francisco Bay, you transferred to a smaller ship, and you sailed to Sacramento, and you disembarked here. So probably 200,000 people came ashore to hunt for gold right on the wharf here in Sacramento on Front Street between about I Street and K Street.
My grandmother had spent her childhood downtown Sacramento, and she had told me about her memories when she was about 9 years old of the Spanish flu epidemic. And I've met a lot of people who never heard of that, so I'm wondering if maybe the port was a factor in the higher numbers in certain areas more than others.
I don't know much about that particular epidemic. I'm aware of its place in the historic record. But any place where people are concentrated is what a bacteriologist would call a vector source. It's a good place for contamination. In the same way today that schools and airports and any place where people are crowded is a place where a lot of things can be passed to one another. Certainly in those days, we didn't have the hygiene standards that we had today, and people weren't as aware of viruses and infection rates and things like that. So it's pretty likely that waterfronts and wharfs would have been high probability for that. Plus, by this time, any place that has railroad tracks and docks in it is a little bit of a seedy place, and you have people hanging around who are a little less clean than say, some other people in the higher class parts of town.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
That's what crossed my mind. It was an interesting anecdote where she said they lived across the street from a funeral parlor, and the bodies would just be coming all day long, and her grandmother would sew the masks for all the kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Old Sacramento had pretty large establishments because it was... Now, from Old Sacramento to, say, downtown Sacramento, where would you consider the hub besides the obvious port?
In the 1850s to about the 1880s, what we call today Old Sacramento was the center of town. That's because all the commerce happened here, because steamships were a major form of transport for both people and goods. The railroad was a major place of transport. So there were a lot of wholesalers here. There were a lot of banks and trading houses, a lot of merchants. If you look at the old records for the Sacramento Union, which was the paper record at the time, you see the big businesses clustered right here along the waterfront. But as the city develops and as road systems improve and as people need to get away from the river for sanitation reasons, for reasons of flooding and just city growth, you start to see the city begin to move eastward. The proximity to the state capital was also a big draw to draw business and political leaders closer to the physical structure of the state capital. Businesses just generally moved east, and of course today with the internet and telephones and transportation networks, you can be a big presence without being physically located at any one place. So it's kind of irrelevant today.
Now, of course, some of the buildings are generally historical just due to their age. Some of them hold a significant historical aspect of California.
Oh, more of them than we think do. And one of the reasons that Old Sacramento State Historic Park exists, or any historic park, is to preserve significant physical elements of whatever history you're studying. So this state park includes the B.F. Hastings Building, built in 1854. It's one of the oldest buildings in Old Sacramento, and it was the home of California's first Supreme Court chambers.
Ah.
It was also the office for the first telegraph office in California, and it's significant in both of those instances because the very first transcontinental telegram was sent from the B.F. Hastings Building by a member of the Supreme Court to President Lincoln in Washington, promising California's loyalty to the Union. And that was really important because that was right after Lincoln's election, and Lincoln had only won California by about 635 votes, somewhere in that range. So it easily could be that California wouldn't have been loyal, but it was important to establish that loyalty because California's gold helped finance the Civil War. If that gold had somehow gone to the Confederacy, we might all be drinking mint juleps today and saying y'all a lot more than we do.
But without the humidity.
The Hastings Building was also the banking center of Sacramento at that time. When you came down from the hills with your poke of gold, you had it assayed and you had it shipped from the Wells Fargo office or the B.F. Hastings Bank, both of which were located in that building, or a bank nearby, on stagecoaches that all gathered around that place, and it was taken to the San Francisco Mint, or prior to that, it was taken to ships to be taken back to Washington to add to the U.S. Treasury. So Old Sacramento is sort of like the real tight point on a funnel. Everything comes from far and wide and focuses right here, and then it gets spread out again to other places. So it's sort of like the spoke of a wheel or the tight place of a funnel, but Sacramento was the nexus of California's economy in the 19th century. Sacramento is a very Midwestern town in many ways, but it's hard to compete against the beauty and the incredibly good deepwater port of San Francisco. It's hard to compete against the incredible weather of the Los Angeles area. But Sacramento has been the seat of state government. It's been a very powerful place in arguably the nation's most influential and powerful state, and certainly the one with the biggest economy. And that all centers around Sacramento. And I think overall, Sacramento's probably done a good job of growth. But we do perhaps lag behind a few other people in some real high tech and real sexy things. But so what?
We'll get there.
Yeah.
But it also has two main rivers.
Right.
One which you can cruise down and one which you can water ski on. And the two actually meet behind Old Sacramento.
Right. The confluence of the Sacramento and the American River. That's another one of those unique Sacramento things because a lot of people just don't realize it. But the American River was actually moved a little bit north by hand labor in order to reduce the flood potential here in Sacramento City. And the gravel and things that was removed by hand and by dredging to move that river north and make it a little straighter and make it a better connection with the Sacramento River, a lot of the sediment ended up being put into the streets of Sacramento, which is still another story because about a half mile north-south and about 2 miles east-west, the city was literally raised between 10 and 14 feet, depending on where you are, to raise the level of the streets, and the business owners and building owners were required to raise their buildings or add another story to make Sacramento higher above the river to reduce the flood risk.
How many times did it actually flood?
Oh, more times than I can count. It would flood every 2 or 3 years. Governor Stanford, when he was inaugurated governor, he had to row in a rowboat from his mansion over to the state capitol to be sworn in. A lot of houses you still see in Sacramento in downtown and midtown are from that era, and they have raised semi-basements with the living quarters being about 10 feet off the ground. So you see these great staircases going up to the main floor of the house. Those were built in a time when you sort of planned that you would occasionally be flooded. But this is part of the California Delta. It's part of the natural occurrence. In a certain way, it's a really dumb place to have a city. But it shows you how important Sacramento was, and the real drive of the early city fathers, that rather than moving it, which frankly I think might have been easier, they said, let's raise the darn thing. And they did this at a time when there were no dump trucks, there were no skip loaders, there were single axle carts, and there were regular wagons, and there were shovels, and there were thousands of low paid laborers. And shovel by shovel, they raised the streets. They built brick walls. They built like coffer walls to raise the sides of the streets, and they filled in between them. And then they required the property owners to not only raise their buildings or add an extra story, but also put in sidewalks. And just the sheer amount of work involved in doing that, if you imagine that, it's just stunning. So if you walk through Old Sacramento, you see all sorts of instances of both buildings that have been raised and buildings that have had extra stories added to them. And you can tell by looking at some of the architectural features of the buildings. The alleys were not raised, so the alleys in Old Sacramento generally descend to about the normal level pre-1865. And you see semi-buried windows that have been bricked over. So that's a building that was the original first floor, and they just added an additional floor to the building. You see others that have different kinds of foundations underneath, and they were literally jacked up with these screw jacks, sometimes 30 to 50 jacks under a building, and they would all simultaneously turn screws and raise them an inch or a half inch at a time over several days, and then build a new foundation underneath. And they did this sometimes with people actually living in the buildings. There's a story that we've seen in old newspapers about a particular wood-framed hotel that was full of residents one night when it collapsed because it was being jacked up not in an even manner, and the whole thing just collapsed full of people. Apparently no one was killed, but they That's all had good. A really terrible night. You also see stories about so-and-so, the relatively wealthy merchant who owned a wholesale grocery store, who is coming home after a wonderful night at the theater in the saloon, and he reaches the end of the raised sidewalks and comes to the next property where a sidewalk hasn't been built. But because it's pitch black, because there are no streetlights, he pitches over and he breaks his leg. It's sort of a normal occurrence in those days. We weren't quite as litigious as we are now. But it was a rough and tumble place, but a frenetic beehive of activity. And it shows you how really important people thought Sacramento was. Now, John Sutter, who was really the first non-native resident of this country, he put Sutter's Fort on the high spot that he found, about 3 miles upstream on the American River. And today it's about level with the rest of town because that part of town has been filled in around him. But that was above the floodwaters. And he didn't favor what we now see as Sacramento as the town. He actually surveyed another town that's on a little higher ground, a little downstream, and we know that today as Sutterville. But it never caught on. And it was his son, actually, John Sutter Jr., who, when Sutter's debts began to mount as the gold seekers came in and overran all of his land claims and stole his cattle and basically wreaked havoc on everything he knew, he turned his holdings over to his son, Sutter Jr., and Sutter hired two army surveyors, who was Lieutenant Ulysses S. Grant and Lieutenant William Tecumseh Sherman,
wow,
to survey a city of Sacramento. And one of the unique things about Old Sacramento State Historic Park is that Block A, Lot 1 of Sacramento is at the corner of Front and I Streets. And that's the very first lot surveyed in the city of Sacramento.
Hmm.
And it was surveyed by these two Army lieutenants, who we later know from their great fame and exploits in the Civil War a few years later.
Right.
But they laid out the city of Sacramento, and they did a marvelous job with it. It's still the street grid that we use today.
And the Pony Express?
Oh, the Pony Express, a short-lived but really dramatic part of American history from April to October of 1861, just ahead of the telegraph and just really a little bit ahead of the railroad, carried mail between St. Joe and Sacramento. And the Hastings Building, and I forgot to mention this earlier, the Hastings Building was the western terminus of the Pony Express. Letters were received there, and they were also mailed from there. And the horses would ride in with their riders. They would do a quick swap and change saddlebags real quickly, and then head back east towards St. Joe, Missouri. From here, mail that was destined for the Bay Area would be put on steamships at the wharf at Front and K Streets, and it would be transported down to Benicia, and then carried across on another ferry, and then taken over to San Francisco or San Jose or wherever things needed to be at that time.
Now, were any of the bridges out here during that time when it was still a...
Well, there was an I Street bridge on pretty early, and I've seen pictures of the original from, I think, 1861. But prior to that, the way you bridged the rivers was to swim across or take a ferry across. And in fact, where the I Street Bridge now stands, the big iron bridge with the trains and the traffic on it, originally there was a ferry. And about where the Sacramento History Museum is, just a little bit upstream of that, there was a place called the Ferry Hotel. There were actually several ferry hotels. There was one on the block of Front and I Street as well. So there was a ferry that crossed right through there. But an I Street bridge went in pretty quickly, and it's been, I think we're on the third or fourth iteration of an I Street bridge. And the city right now is talking about building a new bridge a little bit upstream and taking the automobile traffic off of the current I Street bridge because the traffic lanes are somewhat narrow, and they would build a wider one to facilitate traffic between Yolo County and Sacramento.
But maintain this current High Street Bridge for pedestrian or bicycles?
It would be, I'm not sure about the pedestrian or bicycle use, but certainly for the rail use. The bridge is owned by Union Pacific Railroad. When it was first opened in 1911, primarily the non-railroad traffic was carts and buggies, because that's what was prevalent back then. Today's cars are a lot different than horses and buggies. They're a lot different than early cars. So it's not really considered modern or wide enough. But it is a remarkable bridge for being 100 years old and still fulfilling its original structure.
Not too shabby.
Its function. It's also a swing bridge. It opens, and it opens on a center pivot in the river and turns sideways. And that's because when it was built, there were steamboats plying the river up and down. And there was a lot of freight and a lot of passenger traffic. So we still see that open on weekends when the Hornblower yachts and other large ships come through there. Same thing with the Tower Bridge, except the Tower Bridge is called a lift bridge, and the center span rises vertically on those two beautiful golden towers. And when those bridges open, the sirens go off and you see it happen, and it's kind of amazing to see that out here.
Pretty dramatic.
It's pretty dramatic, yeah.
Now, you have underground tours here, is that correct?
The Sacramento History Museum sponsors them. And so they're booked through the History Museum itself. But yeah, the underground tours take place partly on old Sacramento State Historic Park properties and in the basement of the Hastings Building. But they take you through several buildings, the Hall and Lures Building, and underneath where that building today sits, there was a tin shop. So archaeological studies down there revealed evidence of both the tin shop and evidence of a boarding house for somewhat improper ladies. But there are perfume bottles and horn combs and evidence of the ladies who used to occupy some of that spot, along with tin shop debris and some old tools and things like that. Underneath the Hastings Building, there's other evidence of prior structures. The Hastings Building was rebuilt over a building that burned in the fire of 1852, which destroyed most of Sacramento at that time.
Any ghost stories?
Well, there's always ghost stories, sure. Just depend. There's nothing dramatic. There's no haunted ghost that caused people to scream out in terror. But even here in the building that we're in today, we're in the State Park office in the Hastings Building. In the Big Four Building, the Huntington Hoppins Hardware Store, just next door to us. But it's linked to this building with a common doorway is the Dingley Spice Mill, which dates from 1854 as well. And that was owned by a man named Nathaniel Dingley. He ran a business downstairs and he lived upstairs. And the people who work in the upstairs have told me several times that they do feel Mr. Dingley's presence in there. We know that when he passed away, there was a viewing in the upper floor for his body, so perhaps he's still hanging around. We've also heard reports of general feelings of a presence in the Hastings Building. No one is sure what that presence might be. It might be someone related to a Supreme Court case. It might be someone related to the banking history or the telegraph history, the railroad history. But none of these are really what you might consider scary apparitions. They just kind of let you know that they're there.
Just overseeing.
Just overseeing. Now, the building that I work in is a historic building from the 1850s, but it's been reconstructed. So we think that when they tore it down and moved it and reconstructed it, they probably let all the ghosts out, because I've never felt anything in it.
Not the way that they left it.
We think about 30% of it is really original, so that doesn't leave many places for a spirit to haunt it or hang out.
Well, tell me about the Railroad Museum that's here in Old Sac.
Well, the Railroad Museum is one of the most visited state parks in California. It receives over 600,000 visitors a year. It is part of Old Sacramento State Historic Park, and it's the largest railroad museum in North America and either the second or third largest one in the world. And it's really, really quite significant because it sits about 2.5 blocks from where the first rails were laid for the Transcontinental Railroad. And it sits at the site where the first locomotive brought for the Transcontinental Railroad was first assembled and put up to steam. Where our ticket office is used to be a machine shop called Goss and Lombard. And we've seen woodcuts of it. We know precisely where it was because of property records. And we know that when the Governor Stanford locomotive was brought partially assembled in crates to the waterfront in Sacramento on a sloop, that the crates and the frame on wheels was rolled up on wooden rails to the Goss and Lombard machine shop, and their machinists assembled the thing. They filled it with water, they put some wood in the firebox, and they first brought it up to steam right where our ticket office is today. And so the locomotive that we have on display sits about 40 yards from where it was first put to steam back in 1863. I think that's very cool.
It's very cool.
We try to focus on superlatives that focus on the history of railroading in the West with an emphasis on California. So we have the Governor Stanford locomotive, we have the C.P. Huntington locomotive. Those are two locomotives that remain from the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. They're two of the oldest locomotives that still exist. We have locomotives from all the way from the 1860s until the 1980s, and we like to cover the general history of railroading, particularly in California at that time. So we have some real superlatives. In addition to the Huntington and the Stanford, we have Southern Pacific 4294, which is the last surviving cab forward locomotive. And it's unique because it's a steam engine that's called a cab forward. When you think of what steam locomotives look like, they always have a smokestack in the front that billows huge plumes of black smoke, steam comes out, and there's a cab behind that where the engineer and the fireman sits. If you run over Donner Pass, and there were 34 miles of snow sheds or tunnels in that route, being about 10 feet behind a smokestack is a bad thing if you're an engineer or fireman. So somebody brilliant back in the late 19th century came up with an idea. Why don't we put a cab forward together? Why don't we put the cab where the engineer and the fireman sit ahead of the smokestack? So they built those primarily for Donner Pass use. And that saved a lot of lives because traditional steam engines were sometimes killing their engineers by forcing them to breathe in hot, superheated exhaust gases. Hmm. Apparently, you didn't care about the passengers so much because they'd already paid their fare. I still haven't figured that one out. Actually, the cars were sealed. But these were much safer, and the cab forward that we have was the last one built for the Southern Pacific. It was built in 1944, and it's the second largest locomotive ever put in service. It weighs 1 million pounds unloaded, or as one of my colleagues likes to remind me, it weighs about the same as 75 full-grown African elephants.
That's a good visual.
It's a good visual, but it's a huge, huge locomotive, and it hasn't run since 1956. And it won't run again because there's no track available for something that large. But when you look at the motion pictures of it operating, it has multiple things that the steam does. It powers the locomotive, but it also powers turbines and compressors, and the steam is used in every conceivable way. And it was a thing of beauty to watch it move. One of the things that we miss, people that didn't experience the steam days, is how really beautiful and kind of sensuous that steam locomotives are, because you have drive rods that move, you have piston valves that open and expel steam, you have steam whistles that sound, and you have things coming out and things moving in ways that diesel locomotives just don't do. Diesel locomotives are much more efficient. If I ran a railroad, I would go to diesel in a heartbeat because it's so much simpler, so much less expensive. Steam engines are really complicated, but they do these magnificent things. And I just learned a few weeks ago that steam can expand up to 17,000 times its size. This is what gives steam its power. A cup of water turned into what's called dry steam, superheated steam, will be 17,000 cups of steam. So when that pushes against a piston, that has tremendous force, and that's what turns those wheels. That's what put America in motion. Until railroading came to the United States in the 1830s, we were basically in the same mode of transportation that had prevailed since pre-biblical times. We were on foot, or we were on horseback, or we were on sailboats. Suddenly, there was this powerful force that could move things independently of our actions just by feeding it. And suddenly, we could move at 25, 30 miles an hour. Suddenly, instead of a four-month journey across the continent, or 7 or 8 weeks around the Hornet sailing ship, you could cross the continent in 12 days. What this did for California was profound, because it allowed California's Central Valley, all the way from Redding down to Bakersfield, to become an agricultural paradise, because there's these wonderful soils and there's these great water sources. But suddenly you had a place where you could ship your crops. So you could farm and you could have places to sell your crops. For people back east, it meant that in the cold, bitter, sub-zero winters of North Dakota and the bitterly cold winters in Illinois and Connecticut and Maine, you could get fresh fruit from California. You could get citrus fruits. And they would come in these beautiful, colorful labels with these beautiful purple mountains and row crops and these wonderful apple-cheeked, complexioned ladies and gentlemen on these labels with these great names like Liberator and Bounteous Harvest and all of these great things. And it created this mythology of California and helped draw people to the state to make California even more diverse. But it connected California at the time with the rest of the nation. When the Transcontinental Railroad was built in the 1860s, there was nothing east of us till you got to the Missouri River, except for the Mormon settlement in Salt Lake. So California might as well have been Hawaii. What the railroad did, starting here in Sacramento, was get a tangible link to the rest of the United States. So we prospered economically, we prospered developmentally, we prospered socially. We allowed people who'd come west during the gold rush to revisit their families. When people came west in 1849, although they said, I'm going to get rich and I'm going to come back, honey, and everything's going to be great, logically, they really couldn't do that. But suddenly, when railroads came through, you could do that. It revolutionized the world. It revolutionized the nation. Kind of parallel to that, but not in Sacramento, was the completion of the Suez Canal that same year. So both the Suez Canal, which cut you from having to take a trip around the Horn of Africa, and the Transcontinental Railroad made our globe shorter. And it made Mr. Stanford, Mr. Crocker, Mr. Huntington, and Mr. Hopkins incredibly rich. It created a whole new rich class of people, but it also created a huge middle class, and it created all sorts of industries that couldn't exist before. And it helped change our nation from little separate entities into a very cosmopolitan, interdependent society that we are today, that I think we all still benefit from. It all happens right here in Sacramento, and this is the genesis of all that stuff. So when people say, well, San Francisco is a tech center, so what? LA is the entertainment center, so what? Sacramento is still the center of the world. Without what happened here in the building that we're in right now, talking in, none of that would have been possible. It would have happened eventually, but it wouldn't have happened in the same way. So Sacramento is really, really a very important, really vital place in not only California's history, but the nation's history.
I'd imagine you receive a lot of international visitors, probably especially for the Railroad Museum.
Mm-hmm. And it depends a little bit on how the economy does internationally every year. This year we're seeing a lot of German people. We're seeing a lot of French people. We tend to see a lot of Asians as well. They have a very strong economy too. And just before you arrived today, I got contacted by a Chinese film company. They are preparing a documentary on the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad that will be shot from a Chinese perspective, since the Chinese were so important in that story.
And but not treated well.
Well, not treated well in an objective way, certainly discriminated against, but compared to how Chinese were treated outside of the railroad community, the railroad was kind of generous to them, and they actually honored them, and they were protective of Chinese compared to the non-railroad community.
Well, I wouldn't compare. They weren't treated as well as they could have been. Comparison aside.
Yeah, but it's important to put it in context. For the time, they were treated decently, but certainly not through our lenses. But we have a different perspective than people do. And years from now, people will look at what we do today and say, well, we're treating people better than we did back in 2014. It's important to keep that in mind, I think, because Stanford, when he ran for governor, one of the planks of his platform was a strict anti-Chinese plank.
Wow.
But Stanford was one of the main beneficiaries of Chinese labor in building the railroad, and he changed his opinion based on that experience.
There we go.
When Governor Stanford had a painting commissioned called Driving the Last Spike that now hangs here in the museum and used to hang in the state capitol, he made a point of insisting that Chinese workers be put in that, when in fact you don't see them in the photographs taken of the event. But during the actual event, Stanford insisted that Chinese workers would be the ones who ceremoniously brought in the final rail to connect. So they were honored at that ceremony. He made, and other people in the railroad made, statements about the industrious, hardworking nature of the Chinese. They were still discriminated against, but lesser than they would have been had they just been out in the community trying to make a living. When you were Chinese then, you couldn't own property, you couldn't have a mining claim, you certainly couldn't marry outside of your race, you were restricted to certain parts of town you could live in. They didn't want Chinese here. So they still weren't treated equally, but it was less unfair. And I think it's important to understand that all of these things are an evolution in how the human society progresses.
So it's literally moving ahead with the railroad.
Literally moving ahead, yes.
And people's ideas and perspectives and
well,
values.
Well, and many Chinese were pretty happy with the railroad overall. There were certain Chinese people that were kept on the payroll into the 20th century, and they were relegated to non-important jobs. Relatively, they were cooks in railroad stations and things like that. But many of them were honored by the railroad, and you see anniversary celebrations of parades and things celebrating the 25th and 50th anniversary of the completion of the railroad, and there's usually a float involved that has Chinese workers on it that are pointed out as these are the guys who did this. So they acknowledge the Chinese contribution. It was still directed by white people. It was still engineered by white people. But the Chinese did the backbreaking work, and they recognized how valuable that was in the context of the times.
In addition to the Railroad Museum and the infamous Historical Corner, are there any other spots that visitors should keep an eye out for?
Well, Front and K, there's several historic markers there, one for the Pony Express steamboats, but one that we've put up that acknowledges that site as the place where the first rails were laid, the first dirt was turned for the Transcontinental Railroad on January 8th, 1863. Because we're still working on how to commemorate that for the 150th anniversary of completion in 2019, there will be something more substantial there in the future. but that's also the main wharf into Sacramento. So all of that is the real hub of Sacramento's transportation history. And that's at K Street. And K Street is the real center of Sacramento. That's where the K Street Mall was. That's where the new Kings Arena will be going, right along K Street. It leads on up to the state capitol. Just a block south of that is, or two blocks south of that is Capitol Mall, which of course leads directly to the state capitol. Tower Bridge is where Capitol Mall is, and that's not really part of Old Sacramento State Historic Park, but it's close by. And that was both the Lincoln Highway, the first automobile road across the United States, as well as Highway 40. So many of us who are in our middle ages, like I am, our parents came to California on the Lincoln Highway or Highway 40. That was the predecessor to Interstate 80, and that's how people commuted back and forth between the Bay Area and inland California, especially up to Lake Tahoe. So the Tower Bridge is this wonderful Art Deco bridge that is in wonderful shape. It's painted gold, and when the light's just right, it just glimmers like gold. It's a really wonderful thing to see. The waterfront is undergoing a revitalization for the state park. We've recently completed a general plan that will guide our development for the next 20 years. Pending funding, everything's always pending, having the money to do it, but we want to reconstruct more of the 19th century part of Sacramento on some land that we own. We know that underneath the grassy area that we have, there are ruins from that period of Sacramento, and we would like to expose them and then build some replicas of 19th century buildings above them while still letting you explore the ruins of really early Sacramento.
Nice.
We want to do more with events, and then in Labor Day weekend, there's always Gold Rush Days in Old Sacramento, where we and several other organizations erect a tent city and invite people to come in and pan for gold and listen to early music and learn how to do dances of the time and see what life was like in Old Sacramento without the cholera, without the early death, without all the dirt and sanitation problems. We only go so far with that. We run our Sacramento Southern Railroad excursion train along the levee of Sacramento for about 3 miles. And hopefully later this year, but I don't have a date, we'll reintroduce steam locomotion to our trains. Our steam engine's been out of service for several years. It went down for an inspection. We found some issues that really needed heavy maintenance on it. And because the budget has been so low, we've had to do a lot of fundraising. But that locomotive's being currently rebuilt. And we hope, knock on wood, to put it back in service later this year.
Nice.
Halloween time in October, we run a spookomotive train that's operated by our skeleton crew, by the way. And we have a lot of fun with Halloween-themed trains. And then along from Thanksgiving to just before Christmas, we run the incredibly popular Polar Express train, which is a sellout within just a couple of hours of when tickets are open. And as long as I mention that, I should mention that really the best way to get a ticket for Polar Express is to be a member of the museum, and you can do that on our website, but you have to become a member before the first part of September or you lose your chance to get early ticket preference for Polar Express. But we want to do more with running our trains. We own actually 24 miles of right-of-way, but again, depending on the funding, we will put more track in service as we'd like to. We would like to extend train service down to the Sacramento Zoo and have a reciprocal arrangement with the zoo. The zoo likes that idea, we like that idea, but there's a lot of prep work and there's a lot of permitting and of course, inevitably the cost for doing those things and making the track safe and building a platform and arranging the schedules and having the sightings and doing everything you should do. Because our railroad, like most things connected with the museum, is all run by volunteers. We have very few paid staff here. Likely when you come to the Railroad Museum or Old Sacramento, if you talk to someone associated with state parks, they are more than likely a volunteer. And so without volunteers, we couldn't do a thing. And right now, we're actually running a volunteer training class that goes on for 6 weeks. We'll run another one, I think, in the fall. We'll run another one next spring. We have a continuing need for volunteers because people have busy lives, but we always want more help. So if you're interested in that, come down and see us as well.
Come on down. Mm-hmm. So sarsaparilla would be something to order if you were coming to Old Sac, if you mm-hmm. wanted to step back into time. What else would you
order?
Well,
people can get more adult beverages. There are several full-service bars in Old Sacramento. But sarsaparilla, ginger ale, teas, and different flavored waters are always good. You don't have to necessarily stick in the 19th century. It's hot now. It's mid-July here in Old Sacramento, and shaved ice is usually a good solution, as is ice cream, as is a lot of things here.
Well, I noticed the River City Saloon, that's fairly new.
The River City Saloon, I have lunch there occasionally.
What was that before? I don't remember.
Well, that's on 2nd Street, and I don't remember what business was in there previously, yeah. But that whole row historically was euphemistically called bathhouses. And okay. That's where some women that might have had a lesser idea of propriety than others plied their trade.
The epitome of diplomacy.
I don't know who the audience is for your podcast.
Well, it's everybody.
There's actually interesting stories about that particular section of town, including one of a rather well-known woman of the evening who was seen one day running buck naked down Second Street with a knife chasing a client who had stiffed her on payment. She was written up in the paper. Some of the women, by the way, were rather substantial property owners in Sacramento. Some of the women who were madams made sizable investments and owned big chunks of property. We find them in the property records, but they're always euphemistically listed as businesswomen. We're also near what was the Chinese Quarter of Sacramento. That's just actually just across the freeway where the federal courthouse is and where the Perco's Coffee Cup is and that area. And there's still some Chinese apartment houses and things there today. But historically, that was the segregated part of Sacramento where Chinese were isolated to live at. And when they built the federal courthouse, in fact, they found a lot of Chinese-era artifacts, and some of which are on display in the lobby of the courthouse if you go visit it. There's also the Amtrak station nearby, and the Amtrak station itself is pretty neat because that's the former Southern Pacific Depot built in 1923 and 24, and it's built actually in what was a former lake bed. It's right adjacent to the Sacramento rail yards, and the rail yards are there because the city gave basically part of Lake Sutter, which was kind of a swampy overflow area of the American River, to the railroad on the provision that they fill it in over time. And indeed, they did fill it in, but that's all sediment and unconsolidated things. So as they redevelop that site, they're having to do a lot of soil compaction. They're having to clean up a lot of toxic waste, and it involves dealing with entities that have control over the river because legally that area is still considered a navigable waterway. And that's of interest to us because the shops complex over there is where the Railroad Museum's restoration shops are located. And sometime in the future, when we acquire title to two of the buildings over there, that will become the site of the future Rail Technology Museum. The museum today that we just call the Railroad Museum is actually the Railroad History Museum, and we focus on the history of railroading here. In the other facility, which will exist in 19th century shop buildings that have only been used for railroad maintenance and building, we will have a technology museum, so we'll show our restoration shops. You'll be able to tour them in a safe way above all the hubbub of welding and hammering and bending and sawing. But you'll also have a museum where you can do railroad simulations and learn about railroad safety and new technologies such as maglev technology and different forms of high-speed rail and different forms of propulsion. There'll be games and things about how do you put a train together, and trains are really complicated. You don't just stack cars together. You have to do them in a certain order so that your freight goes to the right customers in the right order and everything's done in good stead. So there's all kinds of things associated with technology, how wheels are made, how speeds are done, the new changes in rail technology and how rails are laid, and how do we make trains faster and more efficient and consume less fuel. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that will go into that, but that's several years off and millions of dollars out. Everything here is sort of stays the same historically, but it all changes day to day. Sometimes it changes minute by minute. We have a very dynamic environment here.
Do you remember any old nicknames or taglines that Sacramento used to have back in the day?
Well, I know of Sacra Tomato. I know of Sac City. One of the most fun things for me is in the 1960s, when they were talking about preserving this section of old Sacramento, a documentary film was made called The Marshes of Two Street. And at the time, Front Street and Second Street were a very definite low-class skid row. You see this in the film. It's a lot of down-and-outers, a lot of liquor stores and check-cashing places and places to get a handout. There's still signs up on some of the walls for Morello's Hotel with dollar-and-a-half rooms and things like that. And the Wide Awake Employment Agency, I like that one. But they had this film called The Marshes of Two Street, so occasionally some friends and I refer to this part of town as The Marshes of Two Street.
Very cute, but not anymore.
But not anymore. It's a really vibrant and really fun place.
And for family, all ages.
Oh, absolutely. This is a great family location. We've been talking about the Railroad Museum in Old Sacramento State Park, but there's also the Old Sacramento Schoolhouse Museum. There is the Sacramento History Museum. Just walking along the streets gives you this great sense of history.
And you have that long produce.
And well, that's called the Freight Depot, and the produce shops are not in there mostly anymore. That's all kind of gone away economically. There is still one produce stand in there.
Well, I noticed, I thought, well, the pain it is to get there, find a parking spot, pay for parking, and get it and leave, and it didn't seem to be very...
And that's one reason that particular thing did succeed. That's the wrong project for that area.
Yeah.
But that shed is actually going to be opened up again. Historically, that was what's called a pole shed. It was a warehouse without walls.
Okay.
And the produce market was closed up in an attempt to make stalls for things that didn't work. So again, pending funding, the walls will be removed. It'll be returned to what looks like a pole shed. That will open up the view shed along the river. It will invite more things like performances of bands and street performers and things like that. And it will just make the things more vibrant. We run trains every weekend here in Old Sacramento. This summer, the History Museum and the Crocker Art Museum nearby and the Railroad Museum are open late on Thursday nights till 8 o'clock. And so we want you to come down there on Thursday nights, because if you take your ticket from the Railroad Museum or the History Museum over to one of the ice cream shops, you get a dollar scoop of ice cream.
Nice.
Heck of a deal.
What more could you ask for?
Really, on a beautiful, balmy summer night in Sacramento with the Delta breezes coming in, to stroll along the riverfront and eat ice cream with somebody you care about, that's my idea of fun.
And watch the sunset.
And watch the sunset, yeah.
Visit parks.ca.gov to learn more about Old Sacramento's tours, events, and other offerings in this California historical landmark. In my continuing highlighting of national parks, I'm heading over to Yosemite, since this is its 150th anniversary. I love this John Muir quote. "The sublime rocks were trembling with the tones of the mighty chanting congregation of waters gathered from all the mountains round about, making music that might draw angels out of heaven." You can kayak, swim, hike, bike, snowshoe, ice skate, camp. Each season, you see something different. Waterfalls and rivers, lakes and ponds. Backpack deep into Yosemite country, and you will almost feel as if it is truly 150 years ago. Half Dome and the Valley are the two most easily recognized scenes in the world, but the wildlife and environment continually vie for your attention. You owe it to yourself to spend some quality time in this majestic park. If you happen to be in the Corvallis, Oregon area this weekend, check out the town's Da Vinci Days, which includes a kinetic sculpture race, electric cars, art, robotics, lab experiments, hands-on art and science, music and street performers. Do something different. Switch out your wall decor to look at something different.